Toronto under the supervision of John Syke, who happens to be a visitor here this term. He finished in 2001. He went on to become a postdoc here at the Perimeter Institute. And then after that, he went to Cambridge under a Royal Society funded fellowship. Rob is one of the powerhouses of quantum foundations. He's worked on a vast range of subjects. He's worked on quantum reference frames. He's worked on, he's completely rewritten the book on the subject of contextuality in quantum theory. He's currently writing the book in conjunction with John Syke on quantum foundations, and that will be out as soon as next year. And today he's going to talk about something which I think is very close to his heart, which is the issue of whether you can understand quantum theory in an epistemic fashion. I'll let you.
Thanks very much, Nathan. So yeah, the question that I want to focus on today is what are the conceptual innovations in quantum theory relative to classical theories? But unfortunately, that is kind of a mouthful, and so I thought why the quantum was sort of a snappier title for the talk. But really, that's the question I'm interested in. And what I want to try to convince you of is that for at least a large part of quantum theory, you can get it by simply invoking one innovation, which is that there's a restriction essentially on how much you can know about the classical state of a system. So there's a restriction on the kinds of probability distributions that you can prepare. So that's the idea. You start with some sort of classical statistical theory, and you add as a postulate a fundamental restriction on the sorts of distributions that can be prepared. And what you can do is derive essentially a large part of quantum theory in the sense that you're able to reproduce precisely the same operational predictions as you get for that part of quantum theory. Now, when you do this, you can ask, what do the quantum states that you get out at the end correspond to in the statistical theory? And the answer is that they correspond to probability distributions that have some non-zero width. And non-orthogonal quantum states correspond to overlapping distributions. So they don't correspond to points in the classical state space. And so that provides strong evidence for the view that even in the full quantum theory, we ought to think about quantum states as being states of incomplete knowledge about some reality rather than being states of reality themselves. So that's the big picture. Now, sometimes when I tell people about this, they raise the following objection, which is if you think that there's some classical or other kind of state underlying the quantum state, but you think that you can never come to know that, then what's the point of postulating it? If it's something that you can never come to know, then what use is it? You know, why not just discard it because it's empty metaphysics and it's not good science? So I want to address that criticism with the allegory of Plato's cave. Sorry about the bad shadows. I didn't draw this myself. But besides the bad shadows, I think it's quite nice. So Plato has this story where he says, imagine some prisoners that have been put in a cave. They were born there, so they've been there all their lives. And they're chained to these chairs, forced to look forward, unable to move their head from side to side. And they're looking at a wall where there's shadows being cast. So there's some puppeteers behind them casting shadows of various objects onto the wall. And Plato argues that because this is all they've ever known, they will come to think that the shadows on the wall are the reality, they would be wrong. And so for the purpose of this talk, I want you to think of the shadows of on the wall as being like the quantum state. Basically, they're just the quantum state is going to be an incomplete partial description of the reality, or a shadow, if you will. But now I also want you to imagine that one of these prisoners, after seeing these shadow patterns for a long time, comes up with a theory and says, postulate that there's a third dimension, and there are these objects that have three-dimensional shapes, and I can make sense of these shadows I'm seeing by assuming that they're all different aspects of a single three-dimensional object. And it seems to me that that prisoner would be doing good science, because she would be taking a bunch of disparate empirical phenomena and offering a very simple unifying explanation of all of them. But contrast that with the second prisoner, who says, yeah, that's an interesting theory you got there, and I like it. But actually, I think that in addition to this property of shape, all these objects also have a property called color. And the color is totally irrelevant to the shadow. It doesn't affect the shadow at all. But they have it. So I think that would not be good science, because you're postulating something that's hidden, and it has absolutely no explanatory power whatsoever in the theory. So it seems to me that people often criticize these sorts of approaches with, in the back of their mind, the thought that you're assuming something like the color that I'm talking about here. But in fact, what you're assuming is something like the shape. It's something that's really going to have explanatory power in the models. And so that's why it can still be good science. Okay, so here's the game that I'm going to play, which is to consider various different classical theories, and then to consider the statistical theory for that theory. So that's just the theory that describes probability distributions over the classical states, how they evolve over time, what sorts of measurement outcomes you get, how these probability distributions are updated during measurements. And then I want to explore a third kind of theory, which is the statistical theory, but where you impose some kind of fundamental restriction on the sorts of probability distributions you can have. So the case I'm going to be mostly focusing on in this talk is non-relativistic particle mechanics. And the statistical theory for that is sometimes called Liouville mechanics. And the probability distributions are called the Liouville distributions. And I want to introduce a particular kind of restriction on Liouville mechanics, such that you can't know everything. And I'm going to show you how the particular restriction that I've chosen actually, at the end of the day, gives you precisely Gaussian quantum mechanics, which is a subset of the full theory of quantum mechanics for n particles. Now, if you're, say, a field theorist, you might say, well, that's not very impressive. I mean, Gaussian quantum mechanics, Gaussians are trivial. You know, we can do all the math with Gaussians. You know, there can't be really anything interesting in a theory like that. So you haven't really got much of quantum mechanics. But in fact, Gaussian quantum mechanics, although it may be very easy mathematically, contains a lot of phenomena that usually we take to be non-classical. So most of what I would say are the basic quantum phenomena, things like non-commutativity of measurements, interference, coherent superposition, collapse of the wave function, the existence of complementary bases, things like that, are all included in Gaussian quantum mechanics. If you're a quantum information theorist, you may be familiar with the fact that most of what we're interested in quantum information theory is included in Gaussian quantum mechanics, so teleportation, the existence of key distribution protocols, quantum error correction. And then also, you might have heard of quantum improvements in metrology, so things like better clock synchronization protocols, better phase estimation protocols. And all those essentially boil down to using squeeze states, which is already contained in Gaussian quantum mechanics. Also, if you think that entanglement is, you know, the key mysterious non-classical quantum phenomena, then it turns out that most of entanglement theory is a part of Gaussian quantum mechanics. And then finally, various detailed aspects of the formalism, such as the isomorphism between maps on one system and states on two systems, Neumark extensions, Stein-Sprung dilation, all that sort of stuff is all in there. So a great deal of what we usually take to be mysteriously non-classical is already contained in this theory. And so for that reason, I think it's not so obvious that you could get that starting from a classical theory and imposing a restriction. Okay, define what exactly. I will, yeah. So for now, I should just say that imagine pure states that have a Gaussian profile over the configuration space. They are part of Gaussian quantum mechanics, but I'll characterize it more fully. So Gaussian wave packets are part of the full theory. Yes?
Are you going to tell us what's in quantum mechanics but not in Gaussian quantum?
Yes, I will. That'll come up in just a couple slides. Okay, but before doing that, let me just tell you, what other theories I'm going to talk about. So you can play this trick for particle mechanics. So another place where I've investigated this is a theory of classical bits. So these are just two-level systems. Take value 0, 1, you can imagine a collection of them. And think of this as like a circuit. So you have these bits, and you're going to apply gates to subsets of the bits, and you're going to evolve things forward that way. It's like a computation. You could introduce a statistical theory of those bits. So you could say, what if I don't know the values of all the bits? How does my knowledge propagate over time? And then you could imagine adding a restriction to the sort of statistical distributions you can have. And what I'm going to show you is that you can actually get something that's very close to what quantum information theorists call the stabilizer theory for qubits. And that's, like Gaussian quantum mechanics, a subset of the full theory of quantum mechanics for n qubits and two-level systems. You can do the same thing for three-level classical systems, which are called TRITs. And you add a restriction. And this time, you don't get something that's approximately equal to the stabilizer theorem. You get precisely the stabilizer theory. So this is even more analogous to the continuous variable case. And then you can also consider optics. So the theory of statistical optics is pretty well studied. Add a restriction in a particular way, and you get actually all of linear quantum optics. And so those are the cases that I've essentially studied so far. But you can ask obvious questions like, what if you take the theory of classical electrodynamics, fields and particles? As far as I know, this theory hasn't been particularly well studied, although there's some things that have been written. You can add a restriction, and I expect that maybe you get a good approximation to or exactly some part of QED. Don't know. I'll say more about that eventually. And then finally, you can do this for any classical theory. So a natural question to ask is, what if you took a classical theory of gravity over here, perhaps GR? As Lucien has emphasized, we don't really have a good probabilistic theory of gravity. But supposing you could develop such a thing, then you could imagine imposing one of these restrictions. And perhaps what you would get out would be something that was precisely equal to or approximately equal to part of the true theory of quantum gravity, if indeed it's appropriate to have a quantum theory of gravity. So that's just speculative possibilities for the future, where you might go with this sort of thing. Now, of course, this is mostly of foundational significance, but there are also practical applications for this sort of characterization of part of quantum theory. So the first sort of application is for developing quantum technologies. So you might be interested in coming up with new algorithms for quantum computation, or new protocols, new cryptographic protocols, or new improvements to metrology. And I do some of this when I'm not thinking about foundations. And I find that the sorts of insights you get from thinking about quantum mechanics in this way are actually very valuable in trying to develop your intuitions about what protocols might outperform classical protocols. But I think there's also practical applications for modern physics. So in particular, if you want to extend the range of applicability of quantum theory to somewhere where it hasn't been applied, so for example, to cosmology or perhaps to gravity, then I think the sorts of intuitions you get from this approach are valuable. And furthermore, if you find, for whatever reason, that it's worthwhile to try to modify quantum theory, these kinds of approaches give you a way of doing that, because it's a principle-based approach. You're trying to derive part of the quantum formalism from some assumptions. So you can imagine modifying those assumptions and getting something different. And as I mentioned on the other slide, in the case of bits, you do get something which is not quite quantum theory. So those sorts of theories might be interesting for certain applications. Anyhow, that's a bit of motivation for why you might want to be interested. OK, so now I want to get to Lee's question. Obviously, you haven't got all of quantum theory from this sort of approach. So you might say, well, what's the point foundationally? You know, why not just give up at this stage? But I think you actually learn a lot, because you can categorize quantum phenomena now. You can say, well, what are the phenomena that just arise in a restricted statistical classical theory? Put them over here, and find the ones that don't arise and can't arise, that you can prove will not arise in any such theory. So you can write down a list of all the things that you think are mysteriously non-classical. And here's an arbitrary list of things that people at various times have thought of as mysteriously non-classical. And you can start categorizing them. And what you find is that for this particular list, you get most of the things over here on the left-hand side. But there are still things that you can't get. So a prominent example would be the existence of Bell inequality violations. while still being able, unable to signal. Another example is quantum computational speedup, if in fact it exists. You can't get that in these sorts of theories. The Bell-Cochin-Specker theorem, which I'll say a few words about at the end, probably. And then I should also mention that there are various aspects of all of these, or some of these items on the left, which appear on the right-hand side. So actually, what you find is that you know, your old way of categorizing things wasn't refined enough. So for instance, a coherent superposition is something that appears in this theory, but it, you only have a notion of coherent superposition for orthogonal states. You don't have a notion of coherent superposition for non-orthogonal states. So you could say that, you know, what you've discovered is that the thing that you have now trouble explaining with, from this point of view, is those sorts of coherent superpositions. But that's a much more refined sort of mystery. I never met anyone in the past who came to me and said, I don't find coherent superposition of orthogonal states confusing. It's the coherent superposition of non-orthogonal states that really bothers me. So you sort of learn to refine what it is that you ought to find surprising about quantum mechanics. And then finally, there's at present a large list of phenomena that I don't know how to categorize and that I'd like to understand. So prominent on that list are quantization, things like fermionic statistics. I expect quantization to fall here and fermionic statistics to fall there, but I don't know. So the bottom line is that after you do this categorization, the stuff on the left you realize isn't so strange from a classical perspective after all. And maybe you shouldn't have been so surprised by these sorts of things. But the stuff on the right is still very mysterious, and that motivates you to find more of these things. Try to make the list on the right-hand side longer so that you can focus on more of these phenomena and thereby hope to perhaps undercover some principle that underlies the rest of these phenomena, some other conceptual innovation in addition to the statistical restriction that might explain these sorts of things. Yes, Mike.
Yeah. I would say pretty much every single thing on the left, there are some significant aspects of that belong on the right. So it's almost a rhetorical point. What I'm saying is that, like,
well, I would disagree because, as I said, you know, in the case of coherent superposition, the example I gave, I never met anyone who said, when I say coherent superposition is mysterious, I really mean only for non-orthogonal states. I've never met anyone like that. And so, you know, when we just use a one-word slogan for these things and say, I take that to be somehow mysterious non-classical, the way you usually characterize what's mysterious about it is something that you really can explain in these sorts of models. Yes?
So this classical theory, please explain Stone-Gallagher experiment.
Well, I don't know about that completely, but I certainly couldn't do, say, you know, a model of the dynamics. And so I'm not imagining a, I don't have a model of both the motional dynamics and the spin dynamics simultaneously. But the phenomenology of just a sequence of Stern-Gerlach's experiments where I treat the motional degree of freedom classically and I ask about just the spin. If I restrict myself to X, Y, and Z spin measurements, that subset of all experiments already captures most of what we take to be surprising about Stern-Gerlach experiments. And those aspects I can reproduce. So the fact that, you know, a measurement of a Z spin randomizes what outcome you'll get in an X spin, for example, is something that can be reproduced. Well, I'll get to that.
Well, this Rob. Is one of those, are you going to do this later questions, but what the heck. So generally, I've always understood the link between entanglement and Bell inequality violations to be pretty solid. So are you going to explain where the why one's on one side and the other's on the other?
Yeah. So
that's fine.
Well, maybe I should just explain it now, which is that, you know, if you say you know, entanglement, let's say I give you a set of measurements that don't violate Bell inequality. So the original EPR setup, where you know, each observer does only a position or a momentum measurement, that doesn't violate any Bell inequality. But you might still say, well, that's non-classical. There's no good classical explanation of the statistics of that experiment. But in fact, the statistics of that experiment does come out of one of these restricted statistical theories. So so if you're not violating Bell inequality in your experiment, then typically the phenomenology of what you're observing can be reproduced. Does that clarify?
One other related question. Is it possible that if we just restricted ourselves to a left-handed column, that that is a logically possible, fully consistent theory that needs no further correction? Or is it that that theory, this restricted statistical theory, necessarily has holes that would need to be filled by what's on the right?
That's a good question. You could ask, so I don't have any theory on the left that's sufficiently sophisticated to really be able to describe most of physics. I haven't done electrodynamics yet, for example. So maybe someday we could say, this theory is rich enough to actually describe apparatuses and things like that fully. But then you would still be left with the question of, well, why the statistical restriction? And if you want an explanation for that, maybe you need to go deeper. And it's actually, I'm going to speculate that there's things on the right that might explain the starting point of the theories on the left.
Actually raise a logical objection, which is actually related to what Robert Mann said. In actual fact, classical mechanics is a consequence of quantum mechanics, and not the other way around. That is, there is a classical limit in quantum mechanics. You can formulate quantum mechanics without any reference to classical mechanics and obtain classical mechanics as a limit. And therefore, this approach, although it's historically the approach how quantum mechanics was found, has no other logical underpinning other than that historically people learned first classical mechanics for obvious reasons. And then they learned that there is another theory underneath it. And therefore, what you're doing violates logic, not any...
Well, I didn't see any logical contradiction. You're just saying, I prefer to think of one theory as a limit of the other rather than vice versa. But let me address your point. So it seems to me that there's a big difference between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics in terms of the adequacy of the interpretations we have for those theories. I think, personally, that the only adequate interpretation we have of quantum theory is an entirely operational one. What you can use the theory for is making predictions of what's going to happen in the lab. Now, suppose you're interested in studying cosmology, or suppose you're interested in studying the origin of life. It seems to me in those sorts of contexts where you don't have observers around and you don't have the primitives of description that you would use in an operational framework, you're a bit at a loss. And what you prefer to have is what I might call a realist interpretation of quantum theory. And so I'm motivated to, first of all, try to come up with a realist interpretation of quantum theory. So that's one of the motivations here for why I might be dissatisfied with quantum theory today. Secondly, quantum theory starts by laying down certain assumptions, Hilbert space, the fact that systems combine by tensor product, the fact that it's Hilbert space over the complex field as opposed to the real Diffie-Shannon field. We'd like to know why we have that starting point. And this sort of project is an attempt to answer those sorts of questions, to derive the formalism of quantum mechanics. And it seems that quantum mechanics already, starting from classical mechanics, you can already get a motivation for many of those features.
Well, I accept all that, but it still violates logic.
Yeah, okay, I'll carry on. Okay, so roughly speaking, here's the research program. The fact that these restricted statistical theories are very successful suggests that perhaps quantum theory is best understood as a kind of probability theory. Of course, they don't work. They don't get you all of quantum theory. So it can't be the case that quantum states are incomplete descriptions of some local variables, for example. But nonetheless, it seems to me that there's good reason to think that quantum states are still incomplete descriptions of some sort of pre-existing reality that's a bit stranger than we thought. I mean, the first of these, I think many people in foundations community today would agree with that sort of approach. Perhaps fewer would agree with me on this. And so here's the speculative possibility for an axiomatization of the full theory. The first principle is just the one I've been talking about, that there's some sort of fundamental restriction on observers' capacities to know and control the systems around them. But then that has to be supplemented by some second principle. I don't know what it is, but it'll have to be some change to our classical worldview. For instance, it's not local hidden variables. But yeah, really, it's an open question what that second principle might be. I think we really need to work hard exploring these possibilities. We haven't exhausted these things yet. If you tell me some, you know, if quantum state is not knowledge about local hidden variables, well, it could be knowledge about all sorts of other things. You know, my possible views of reality, there's many more than local hidden variables. So I think we should explore these, and ultimately I think it would be nice to have some sort of understanding of where the first principle comes from as well. Okay. Yes?
A question on principle one. So you have, you're motivated by constructing the realist theory, but how do you apply principle one in cosmology?
Well, so as I said, we need to derive principle one, ultimately, right? So I'm not happy with principle one as it stands, because one of its primitive notions are observers. So it would be much, I agree with you that, you know, ultimately, you want to have something where you have no mention of observers at all, because after all, observers are just other physical systems. But this is a stepping stone towards that ultimate goal. So I agree with you.
So given that observers, these are not fundamental things, right? So
yeah.
You're supposed to think that principle one wouldn't be...
Well, but it's, as I say, it's a stepping stone. We start here, and you know, we see how powerful it is. And then next we ask, right, this is not adequate. How do we go beyond? So that's the project. Okay, so let me get into the first of these theories. Is that Raphael?
Yeah, I think. It's a question of clarification. When you say quantum mechanics is best understood as a kind of probability theory,
yeah.
I assume you're not saying something which is very congenial to me, which is that it's a generalized kind of probability, that the notion of probability itself is being generalized. You're saying you use stochastic probabilities, but together with these kind of restrictions you're talking about, or are you going farther?
Well, I don't know. I mean, ultimately, maybe what we'll find is that we have to have some sort of innovations about what our classical worldview, innovations to our classical worldview, such that the physics of observers is different from what we thought. And you know, the theory that observers ought to use to you know, update their knowledge about things around them is not classical probability theory. So I think that sort of approach would fit into this program.
One can see a path integral of generalized probability.
Yeah, perhaps. And I guess I'm particularly motivated to, well, I'll just say, that's, I think that fits as well. Okay, so the first theory I'm going to look at is restrictive Liouville mechanics. So I should say, first of all, this is joint work with Steve Bartlett and Terry Rudolph. And if any of you are looking for a job as a quantum mechanic, it turns out that Australia is higher. All right, so let's remind ourselves of Liouville mechanics. So we have n canonical degrees of freedom. The possible states are described as a point in the 2n-dimensional phase space, and I can write down probability distributions over that phase space that represent my knowledge. And the question is, what would a good statistical restriction look like in that case? And I'm going to look to quantum theory to get some ideas of how to get started. So it turns out that a very nice and general way of expressing the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is this matrix inequality here. So the first matrix on the left is called the covariance matrix. And it contains all the information about correlations between different canonical variables. So along the diagonal, you have the variance in the position of the first degree of freedom, variance in the momentum of the first, variance in the position of the second, and so on. And then here you have the cross-correlation between the position and momentum of the first particle. Here it's between the position of the first particle and the position of the second, and so on, where these quantities are defined as quantum expectation values. And then the second term here involves the symplectic matrix from classical mechanics. And it turns out that if you add the symplectic matrix, the coefficient I h bar, to the covariance matrix and set the whole thing positive, you find that this constraint actually can be derived from the commutational relations. So all quantum states must satisfy this. And in case that's not familiar to you, let me just convince you that it reduces to the standard form in the case of a single canonical degree of freedom. So here's the covariance matrix. Here's the symplectic matrix. You add them up. This matrix inequality is equivalent to demanding that the determinant of this guy be positive, that gets you this general form of the inserting principle, which implies the familiar form. Yes?
Keep interrupting you. The point about Heisenberg and subject principle is such if you take a microscope, you keep improving the magnification resolution. It turns out that you end up not being able to complete accuracy because the photon is quantum.
Well, here I'm not referring to the measurement disturbance version of the principle, which you know, says that if you try to find out about positional disturbance, that will come back shortly in the talk. But here I'm just really thinking of the Heisenberg density principle as a constraint on distributions of complementary variables. So the way you usually interpret this is, were I to do a measurement position and I had this spread for my state, then had I done a measurement of momentum, the spread I got would have to satisfy this inequality. But now I want to just take that uncertainty principle and use it in a different context. So now forget quantum theory. We're back to Liouville mechanics. Everything's classical. But I can define a covariance matrix there as well. So all I do is I write down expectation values of classical variables relative to the probability distribution that describes my knowledge. So for instance, you know, an arbitrary probability distribution will have a variance in position, a variance in momentum, cross correlations, and so forth. So you can define the covariance matrix for an arbitrary distribution in Liouville mechanics. And then you have an obvious place to start, which is you just impose the very same form of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, but now to these classical distributions. Okay, so this is our starting point. This is the, I'll call it the classical uncertainty principle. The only Liouville distributions that can be prepared are those that satisfy this inequality on the covariance matrix. And now this thing only constrains the second order moments of that distribution, because that's all that appears in the covariance matrix. So far all the higher order moments are completely unconstrained. And at this point, I want to just say that observers know as little as possible subject to this constraint on the second order moments. So I'm going to maximize the entropy of the distribution over the phase space subject to that one restriction. And so when I do that, I find that the distributions have to be multivariate Gaussians that have this form where gamma is the covariance matrix. Yes, Rob?
What's the motivation for introducing I? Apart from anticipating.
I doesn't really, you know, it's not the quantum I. It's just a nice way of getting all the inequalities you're interested in. So it just is sort of a very compact way of writing down a whole bunch of inequalities on what you know about various canonical degrees of freedom. It doesn't introduce, you know, my probability distributions are still all positive and real. So nothing, you know, funny has happened here. I'm still just doing probability theory over a classical state space. And it's just that the products of various variances are constrained. Okay, so here's a cartoon for a single canonical degree of freedom of the sorts of distributions you can have. You could have one where delta x and delta p are equal, and you know the product is greater than h bar. But you could also do squeezing. So you could have, you know, elliptical states. You can translate the distribution in phase space. And you could even squeeze it up to the point, for instance, where the distribution over x is completely narrow, which means that the distribution over p has to be completely flat. Or here, you can know everything about the momentum, but then you have to know nothing at all about the position. But what you can't have, according to this restriction, is a distribution where you know both the position and the momentum simultaneously. And you can't have arbitrary sorts of probability distributions. If you look at a pair of canonical systems, well, it's harder to draw because you've got a four-dimensional phase space. But you have uncorrelated distributions where the first and the second degrees of freedom are just in some valid Gaussian states. And you also have correlated distributions. So one example is where you know everything about the relative position between the two systems, and you know the total momentum of the pair. This is something that doesn't violate the uncertainty principle, because the canonically conjugate quantities are the relative position and the relative momentum, or the sum of the positions and the sum of the momentum. But the relative position and the total momentum are not conjugate quantities, and so you can know them simultaneously according to the principle. And so this should remind you of the entangled state introduced by Einstein, Pilsen, and Rosen, and in fact it will map on to that state in the end. Okay, you now ask, what are the valid deterministic transformations that don't violate this postulate we started with, the statistical restriction? And you find that they're the group of canonical transformations that have quadratic Hamiltonians. So they have to be canonical transformations because only those preserve this classical uncertainty principle that I started with. And they have to be quadratic because only the quadratic Hamiltonians preserve the Gaussianity of those distributions. And so what you're left with is basically the group of symplectic affine transformations. So here's an example of a symplectic transformation. Here's a phase-based displacement. That's the affine bit. And if you like, you can also explore the probabilistic transformations that are allowed in this theory. That's a lot more involved, and so I won't go into the details of that. The proofs make use of an analog of the teleportation protocol. But at the end, the bottom line is that you find that the valid maps on one system are isomorphic to the valid distribution over pairs of systems. So for the quantum information theorists, you have a analog of the Choi-Gelmakowski isomorphism in this theory. The next thing you can do is ask, what are the measurements that are allowed that don't violate this statistical restriction? And so those are going to be modeled by sets of indicator functions, which are just conditional probabilities. They tell me the probability for getting outcome k in a measurement, given that the state fit in had x and p as its properties. And so you'll be able to see immediately that there has to be some restrictions on these sorts of indicator functions. Because if I imagine that I have two systems, prepared in a distribution corresponding to that EPR one I showed you. So the relative position is well known and the total momentum is well known. Then if I came along to this guy and I did a measurement which told me precisely what both its position and its momentum was, then I would immediately update the distribution for the distance system to be one that had a fixed position and a fixed momentum by virtue of that initial correlation. And so clearly, that sort of measurement, that final distribution for this guy violates my postulate that these distributions should always satisfy the uncertainty principle. Therefore, I can rule out the measurement which would tell me both position and momentum simultaneously. And so if you ask, in general, what kinds of indicator functions can you measure? Well, here's the distribution you get on system two if you measure this indicator function on system one and you start with that EPR state. Just do the integral and you find it's just a normalized version of the indicator function with a time reversal operation applied. And so if this indicator function is non-Gaussian, or if it violates the covariance matrix condition, then the state of the distance system, the distribution for the distance system, will be non-Gaussian and violate the covariance matrix constraint, and therefore that sort of indicator function is not allowed. So the indicator functions will be precisely the things which, when normalized, are Gaussian and satisfy the covariance matrix condition. And then all that remains is to show that all such functions are allowed measurements. And that involves showing that for any valid bipartite distribution, acting one of those functions on half leaves you with a valid distribution on the other half. And that just involves basically convoluting two Gaussians, looking at how the covariance matrix for the other guy depends on the covariance matrix for this and this, and seeing that if these two guys were valid covariance matrices, then this guy is as well. Yes?
So if I measure a three-point function, I'm outside your theory.
If you measure, sorry,
a three-point function.
A three-point function?
Yeah, if I measure a correlation which is higher order, which is not Gaussian, then that throws me outside your theory. Somehow your theory tells me I'm not allowed to measure.
That's right. The theory is telling you what you can measure. So at this stage, I'm just saying, you know, these are things I have to assume about what I can do in the lab such that this theory is consistent. But ultimately, I'm going to say, can we explain that restriction on what we can do in the lab by treating the apparatus dynamically and just using what we know about the dynamics that are allowed? And you'll find that the answer is yes. You can justify the restriction on what you can do in the lab dynamically. Okay, so I'll build up to that. So that characterizes all of the sorts of measurements you can do. Here's the cartoon. You're able to do measurements that are a set of indicator functions, each of which is a fuzzy measurement of both position and momentum. So each one of them doesn't tell you too much about position momentum, but together they sum up to a uniform distribution. Or I could measure, for example, I could find out everything there is to know about position and nothing about momentum. That's also a set of indicator functions that's allowed. I could find out everything about momentum, nothing about position, but I can't find out both simultaneously, and I can't update my knowledge in arbitrary ways. Yes?
So you haven't talked about update rules yet, measurement disturbance stuff, but is it implicit in what you're saying that non-local update is just Bayesian inference?
Yes. So I am, because I'm starting with a classical framework, I'm imagining that unless I introduce a Hamiltonian that causes two things to interact, they're not changing. But I'm going to treat the measurement case dynamically ultimately, so you'll see what happens in that case. So I think you're pointing to what happens to a probability distribution when you do a measurement. What's the update rule? And so imagine a situation where you initially know that the system has a well-defined momentum, and then you do a measurement of position on it, both of which are valid. Classically, you would then know both the position and the momentum, and so you'd update this distribution. But that would violate our postulate, so measurements can't possibly allow you to do that. So the conclusion is that the only way you have of implementing this sort of measurement must necessarily disturb the momentum, such that what you're left with at the end is something that has a well-defined position, but a completely uncertain momentum. And the reason for that is I'm imagining that this measurement of position is done in a reproducible way. So were I to feed the system back into the device afterwards, I should get the very same outcome. And this is the only probability distribution that satisfies that constraint. So I know this has to be the probability distribution you end with. And that implies that whatever the measurement does, it has to disturb the momentum to become completely random. So this, incidentally, is this disturbance to momentum is the root in this framework of the collapse of the wave function. I'm getting valid distributions that look like, quote, eigenstates of the measurement I'm doing. And also, it's the origin of non-commutativity. If I do a momentum measurement on this guy, I get a definite outcome. But if I first do a position measurement and then a momentum measurement, I get a completely uncertain outcome. So the statistics do depend on the order in which I do position and momentum measurements. But now I want to get to this question of whether I can understand this disturbance to the momentum here as a having a dynamical origin. And it turns out the answer is yes, as I said. So you don't need to introduce any kind of indeterminism into your theory to account for that disturbance. You can assume that all the evolution is deterministic, but you just treat the apparatus itself as a dynamical system. I'm going to model the apparatus as just a single particle, which is going to interact with my system over here by an XP type Hamiltonian. So this is just the standard von Neumann type measurement interaction. And I'm going to presume that the particle describing the apparatus starts out in a state of well-defined position and unknown momentum. And so then this interaction causes the final position of this particle to come to reflect the something about the initial position of this. And so if I measure the position of this guy, I find out about the position of my system. So I can put the measurement one step back, and I simulate the measurement of position over here. But now the key thing here is that if you look at this interaction Hamiltonian, not only does the final position of the apparatus come to reflect the initial position of the system, it's also the case under this sort of interaction that the final momentum of the system reflects the initial momentum of the apparatus. If you just think about the symmetry of this guy. And therefore, by virtue of this interaction, the final momentum of this guy is going to come to reflect the initial momentum of that guy, which is completely unknown. And so the reason I get this unknown disturbance momentum is that it depends on the momentum of the system in the apparatus. And because I had to prepare it in a state of well-defined position, its momentum necessarily had to be completely unknown. And so that lack of certainty infects the system and explains the disturbance. The other thing that you can conclude from this analysis is that it actually makes no difference where you put the cut between what's treated externally in this framework and what's treated internally or dynamically. You could push it one step back if you want. It doesn't matter. All your predictions will be the same. So it's just like quantum theory in that regard. Okay, so finally, what I need to show you is that this really does correspond precisely to Gaussian quantum mechanics. So now I'm going to define what I mean by that. So you need to define some operators, which are called the phase point operators. They're just tensor products over all the different degrees of freedom of phase point operators for each degree of freedom. A given phase point operator has this form, which is just the symplectic Fourier transform of the Weyl operator, which is the phase space displacement operator. So the Wigner representation of a density operator rho is just defined as a decomposition of rho relative to this basis of the operator space. So it turns out that the phase point operators span the operator space. So I can decompose any operator into them. And that decomposition is the Wigner representation. Now the definition of a Gaussian state is just one that has a Gaussian Wigner representation. And so its Wigner representation will look like this. And then all you have to note at this point is that the expectation value for quantum observables, products of position momentum for a given density operator, is precisely the classical expectation value of the classical variables for the Wigner representation. So if I replace my classical distribution with a Wigner representation, do the integral, I get precisely the quantum expectation value. And that means that the classical covariance matrix for the Wigner representation of rho is precisely the quantum covariance matrix for that density operator. Because every density operator satisfies the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that means that these Wigner functions will satisfy the uncertainty principle. So my Gaussian states have Gaussian Wigner functions that satisfy the uncertainty principle. Therefore, they're precisely the states that followed from my statistical restriction. So the states of Gaussian quantum mechanics map on precisely to the ones that I derived. In particular, the distributions are the Wigner representations of the Gaussian states. But then you have more work to do. You have to look at what the Gaussian measurements and the Gaussian transformations are. And those are defined as the ones that preserve Gaussianity. And you have to do it completely generally. So you have to include POVMs and completely positive maps. And if you do all that, you find that their Wigner representations are precisely the indicator functions and the probabilistic maps that the statistical restriction implied. And so you derive the theorem, which is that this restricted Liouville mechanics is empirically equivalent to Gaussian quantum mechanics. So here's just, you know, to flash back at you, you know, all the stuff that you can get in Gaussian quantum mechanics, except now you should be more impressed because you've seen that I didn't have any tricks up my sleeve. I really have derived this subset of quantum mechanics, starting only from a classical theory and a restriction on what you can know. Right, so there are other classical theories you can look at, and I just want to say a few words about some of them that I've worked on. So the next one I'm going to consider is the restricted statistical theory of three-level classical systems, or TRITS. This is joint work with my student in Cambridge, Olaf Schreber. And it builds upon the statistical theory for bits that I worked on previously, and a paper by Stephen Van Enck, which tried to generalize what I had done. And most significantly, a lot of very nice work on the discrete symplectic group that was done by David Gross, who's a quantum information theorist at Imperial College. Again, you ask, what's a good statistical restriction to start with? Does quantum mechanics suggest one? The problem you immediately encounter is that if x and p are now discrete variables, because these are finite dimensional systems, I don't have any non-trivial bound on products of variances. The only non-trivial bound is zero. So you don't have a good form of the uncertainty principle. And so Olaf and I spent a lot of time thinking about entropic uncertainty relations, and we had a huge detour through all sorts of complicated stuff. And in the end, we realized that actually, you know, ultimately you can motivate the restriction the following way. Note simply that in quantum mechanics, the jointly measurable observables are a commuting set of observables. And so this suggests that you should assume that the jointly knowable variables are just a set of canonically non-conjugate variables. And what I mean by that is, for instance, if I was doing continuous case, just variables that would have vanishing Poisson bracket. So the analog of commuting observables. The problem is that the Poisson bracket is not rigorously defined if I'm in a discrete scenario. So I have to specify what I mean by non-conjugate a bit more precisely. So let me do that here. The idea is now I have n degrees of freedom. Each one of them is described by a variable x, which takes its value in the integers mod 3. So these are really three-valued variables. I can introduce a phase space by associating a momentum or discrete momentum with each of these. They also take the variables values in integers mod 3. I can define general canonical variables as just linear combinations of these guys with coefficients in the integers mod 3. And then finally, I can now associate a vector with each of these variables, which is just the collection of those coefficients. And the definition of non-conjugate, or the analog of commuting, is just variables whose symplectic vectors have symplectic inner product equal to 0, where this is just that symplectic matrix from earlier in the talk. All these details aren't so significant. The point is that you can do this, and all your intuitions about what sorts of things commute and don't commute from quantum mechanics go through here. So you can just use those intuitions, and they'll work. So here's the starting point of the theory, which I call the discrete classical uncertainty principle. The only distributions that can be prepared are those that correspond to fixing the values of a set of canonical and non-conjugate variables. And so ultimately, the largest set of non-conjugate variables you can find is half the variables in the phase space. So you can know, for instance, all the positions and none of the momenta. And so this is equivalent to saying that an observer can know at most half of the full set of variables. But furthermore, there's only certain halves of the sets of variables that an observer can know. And then you work out what the valid distributions are, and you find in these discrete phase spaces, you know, you only have four possibilities of what you could know. You could know x, in which case it's one of these three, or you could know momentum, or you could know some linear combination, x plus p or x minus p. You can also look at pairs of systems. So this is the position and momentum of the first, position and momentum of the second. You could know both their positions, in which case you have a product distribution. Or you could have some sort of joint knowledge, like knowing their relative position and their joint momentum. So this is the analog of the EPR state again, all in the discrete case. And you look at the group of deterministic transformations. There are the symplectic affines in this discrete setting. Here's what the symplectics look like. If you do it for pairs of systems, it gets a lot messier. Here's an example of one that sort of has a non-trivial interaction between two of these degrees of freedom. Okay, but now I want to convince you that this is actually equivalent to a subset of quantum theory. So I need to define this stabilizer formalism. So I'm going to do it a little bit differently from the way you may be accustomed to. A stabilizer state turns out to be an eigenstate of a commuting set of canonical observables. So you know, if you just define a discrete position, discrete momentum in this way, and take any linear combination of these guys, those are your canonical observables. Find any commuting set, find the eigenstates of those, and you have your stabilizer states. The more standard way of characterizing them is in terms of an associated set of phase-based displacement operators, or generalized polyoperators. But this makes the connection with my classical theory a bit more explicit. So it's sort of what you would expect the analogous states to be. And now I rely on this very nice result by David Gross, which is that for the stabilizer states, you can introduce a discrete Wigner representation, distinct from the one Wouters introduced, such that all of these stabilizer states are characterized by a distribution that's precisely the ones that I came up with in this statistically restricted theory. And so once you take into account the measurements and the transformations and you do all that work, you come up with the following theorem, that this restricted theory is exactly equivalent to the stabilizing theory for Q-trits. And if you're a quantum information theorist, you know that most of the weird quantum stuff is in the stabilizer formalism. So it really is a very tight, discrete analog of the Gaussian case. Okay, just a couple more. You can define a restricted statistical theory for two-level systems. This is also known as the toy theory, which is perhaps the result I'm most famous for, which you can read about here. And it's slightly different. So I did this a long time ago, and by my modern perspective now, I can say that the starting principle can be phrased as follows. The only distributions that can be prepared are those that correspond to knowing at most half of a set of canonical variables. sufficient to specify the classical state. So there's no reference to non-conjugacy here. And that's because when you work in this sort of discrete phase space, where you just have these binary valued observables, that constraint doesn't work. It doesn't yield the kind of theory you're looking for. So it turns out that in this sort of approach, you actually lean on a constraint of locality that does most of the work that the constraint of non-conjugacy does in the three-level theory. And the truth is, I don't really understand precisely why you can't do the same thing. What you find when you apply this constraint is that you get a theory that is very close to, but not precisely equal to, the stabilizer theory for qubits, two-level quantum systems. What you find is that if you try to generalize these two theories, the bit theory and the trit theory, to any even-dimensional or odd-dimensional system, you get exactly the same thing. For all odd-dimensional systems, you can define your restriction and recover the stabilizer theory for those guys. And for all even-dimensional systems, you get something that's close to, but subtly different from, the stabilizer formalism. And so it seems to me that this is very interesting. I suspect that because these guys correspond to half-integer spin and these guys correspond to integer spin particles, that there's some conclusions to be drawn about fermionic versus bosonic statistics in these sorts of approaches. So the fact that the stabilizer theory for qubits has things like Bell inequality violations in it suggests that fermionic statistics might be something that falls on the right-hand side, be like Bell inequality violations. Chris?
First two restricted classical theories, you appeal to your knowledge of quantum mechanics.
Yep.
In these even dimensional ones, you don't need to do that.
Well,
no,
it's not. It's not the reason. I mean, I know I couldn't recover this theory from my starting point. Why? Because this theory, unlike the stabilizer theory for three-level systems, has proofs of Bell inequalities in it. It has Bell inequality violations. All odd-dimensional systems, when you look to the stabilizer, you have no Bell inequality violations. So you could conceivably get those from a local starting point. Here we know you can't. But it's interesting that you get something that's very close. It's almost modified in the minimal way possible to eliminate the Bell inequality violations and all this sort of weird stuff. So I think they're interesting for that reason. So just a couple more. You can look at optics, and then all you have to do is take position momentum in that first theory I told you about, turn them into electric and magnetic fields, and you get a restricted statistical theory of optics, and you find that it's equivalent to linear quantum optics. So beam splitters, phase shifters, one mode and two mode squeezing operations, Hohmadyne detection, everything you can do with that toolkit, you can explain in this sort of way. Then we come to the question of wave particle duality. You take inspiration from this cartoon and you think, well, maybe wave and particle is like position and momentum. I should assume that it's not one or the other, but both, that there's an underlying classical theory where things have a wave-like and a particle-like property. And in fact, you can make that work in a restricted bit-valued field theory that I worked on with a summer student, Elliot Martin. The idea is just that for each mode, you introduce a configuration space, which is just a bit, and you get a four-state phase space, where one of the bits is an occupation number, the other bit is a discrete phase. And so the state of a mode is either vacuum or occupied, but it's also either zero or pi phase. And you can work out explicitly, you can reproduce the phenomenology of the double slit experiment in the context of Mach-Zehnder. And the key insight is that now that the quantum vacuum is a state of incomplete knowledge, even though there's a vacuum on this arm, right? So the usual mystery is, if the particle went this way, how did it know whether it was allowed to appear in the dark port or not? Given that, how did it know whether there's a detector on the other wing? And the answer is that the vacuum which propagates down this wing has this phase degree of freedom, which can then inform the beam splitter up here of whether there was a detector present or not. So you can work out all the details of such a theory and get the phenomenology right. So you can also look at electrodynamics, of course. Haven't done that yet. But there's a lot of literature on a theory called stochastic electrodynamics, which is very similar to the sorts of things I'm talking about. Unfortunately, the proponents of this theory seem to think that they could derive all of quantum theory, and I don't think that's true. But I suspect that perhaps with my sort of approach, I could get something very similar to the sets of phenomena that they find they can reproduce. So these sorts of things like Casimir effect, Unruh effect, Haranov-Bohm effect, stuff like that, I expect to be able to derive eventually. And of course, you could do that for any classical theory you want. So interesting things to be done. So I will just give you leave you with a couple of comments on what you don't get from statistical restriction, things that appear on the right here. They're obviously key for trying to identify the missing conceptual innovations of quantum theory. So I don't have a good principle for sort of characterizing all that stuff on the right. I haven't come up with one. But what I have found in my research is that you can introduce a generalized notion of contextuality. And I won't explain what that means. But it's essentially just a phenomena as it characterizes non-classicality in a particular way. And what you find is that it's an umbrella for all sorts of different notions of non-classicality that previously we thought possibly to be distinct. But it turns out that they're all particular instances of this generalized notion of contextuality. So the Bell quotient Speckler theorem and all its variants are instances. So's Bell's theorem and all variants of that. New NoGo theorems that I've derived. Von Neumann's famous NoGo theorem is an instance of this, along with some NoGo theorems that Schrodinger proposed. The fact that you require negativity in quasi-probability representations, such as the Wigner representation, turns out to be an instance of contextuality. And then the fact that certain kinds of information processing tasks have a quantum advantage. So with some work with Ben Toner, I show that you can define such tasks that really only work in contextual universes, and blah, 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 so on. So you can make a long list. And I suspect that more things can be added to that list. So usually at this point, if I told you what contextuality was, I would say, and here's what I think the clue that contextuality is giving us on how to come up with some other conceptual innovation. But I haven't had enough time to tell you about that. So I'm just going to assume that you know about Bell inequality violations and run the same sort of discussion based on Bell inequality violations. So for me, one of the most significant remaining mysteries is the fact that you have both Bell inequality violations, which suggest that at the subquantum level, you have superluminal causation occurring. However, you have no superluminal signaling. So despite the fact that you have superluminal causation at the subquantum level, there's no way to make use of that and amplify it to the macroscopic scale to actually send a signal. So that strikes me as very odd, because had we just found Bell inequality violations, had we done some experiments, violated Bell inequalities, and then later found, we can signal as well. Well, we would have found that relativity was wrong. That would have been shocking, but theories change. Maybe relativity is wrong. But here we have a much more bizarre situation where we have no violation of relativity, but we have this tension between these two facts. So what can you do? You can deny that there are Bell inequality violations, experimental loopholes, things like that. I don't think that's a very fruitful option. You could admit the possibility that there is superluminal signaling and that relativity is wrong. And so Antony Valentini has argued for this sort of approach. And he's proven a nice theorem which says that if you have distributions that are subquantum, so there's a narrower than quantum theory allows, distributions over hidden variables, and you have Bell inequality violations and determinism, then you can prove that you can use those distributions to achieve superluminal signaling. So that's an interesting possibility. Personally, I don't think that will be the way to go. My personal opinion is that actually we want a third option, which is deny the tension to some extent. And so we want to find a worldview for which this tension disappears. And so I'm motivated by an analogy to special relativity. Originally, you look at the fact that the laws of physics are the same in null inertial frames, and the fact that the speed of light is independent source, and you say, those things seem contradictory. There's no way, one of them has to fail. But in fact, at the end of the day, you just change your worldview, and you find there is a way of seeing that actually they can coexist. And so it strikes me that we need something similar in this context. And something that's very interesting is that if you take the contrapositive of this guy, so assume that there's no signaling, right? So assume that there's some reason why you have no signaling, but you still have Bell inequality violations. Well, if you add determinism, then you get the denial of this, that you can't prepare subquantum distributions. And that's precisely a statistical restriction. It says that the observers could never come to know more than a certain amount, because otherwise you wouldn't have these two facts. So if you can come up with some deeper reason for this not being a tension, you also have a possibility for deriving the restriction. You need to do a bit more work to get precisely the quantum sorts of distributions, but I think that's an interesting project. And then, personally, I'm motivated to think about ways in which this might be true. I only have very speculative ideas at present, but I'm thinking that perhaps a completely relational view of the world might make these two things seem more consistent, because if, in fact, you just have some dynamics on a relational state space, then it's very easy to have an appearance of non-locality. And what becomes mysterious is why you're not going to have any signaling, why you get an appearance of locality. So yeah, that's pretty much all I wanted to tell you. Thanks for your attention.
Rob, I'd just like to comment on one aspect of your very interesting talk, which is the issue of mystery.
The issue of mystery.
Mystery.
Yeah.
Now, what's mysterious within the theory of first divided subject thing? But it seems to me to be arguable that the uncertainty relations in quantum mechanics are not mysterious. After all, we derive them. They're a consequence of the formalism. They have something very intimately to do with the non-commutativity of operators, subjective operators representing observables. And in particular, they do not commit you to the assumption that the wave function is epistemic. And in particular, they don't have anything intrinsically to do with what I know or don't know, because they're objective features of a quantum mechanical system. Now, if you take that element of quantum mechanics and put it into a classical mechanical setting, it seems to me that you've taken something that's not mysterious and made it extremely mysterious. So all of the consequences follow from that restrictive principle on the left-hand side of that label that you have, that somehow become less mysterious, share the mystery as to why it is that this restriction on your knowledge is holding in a theory that has absolutely no sort of a priori justification. So I don't really see how these things become less mysterious.
So,
and secondly, I can't therefore accept the conclusion that this is a plausibility argument for the claim that the wave function is epistemic.
So you're asking about whether things appear mysterious from the vantage point of the formalism of quantum theory. And the question I'm addressing here is, does something appear mysterious from the vantage point of the classical theory? Right. So when I said all these things are mysterious, I mean mysterious from the perspective of a classical worldview. Now, if you're happy to start with the formalism of quantum theory, then you're not really motivated to look any deeper for explanations of things. But if you want to explain quantum phenomena to somebody who only knows classical physics, then you're first going to have to start by explaining the formalism. You're going to be impeded by the fact that you really only got an operational interpretation, or else something very non-classical like Bohmian mechanics or many worlds or something like that. And the point is that if you just add this one uncertainty principle to the classical worldview, so imagine a student who only knows classical mechanics, and then say, okay, now find out all the logical consequences that would follow from not knowing everything, and you set them off, and they come back and say, oh, this is what I've derived. You say, right, well, now you pretty much understand most of quantum mechanics. I don't need to tell you about Hilbert spaces and all that stuff, because you pretty much get the phenomenology. So I'm interested in deriving your starting point, the formalism of quantum theory. I want to know where that comes from. And so I think to say that things are not mysterious if you start with this formalism, that's not the project I'm engaged in. I want to understand the origin of formalism.
You can't derive the spin statistics theory according to the theory of statistical classical theory. The spin of the particle cannot be described as a theory. So if you try to do the same spin hydrogen lines, it cannot become classical. In the 50s, things were published by peers at Cambridge University claiming you could do quantum electrodynamics through statistical classical theory. And the big fight broke out at Cambridge at the time. And they got people, one, you cannot do quantum electrodynamics through a statistical classical theory. It doesn't work.
I agree. So the project is not to derive all of quantum electrodynamics. It's to derive, to find out how much of quantum electrodynamics does follow from those assumptions. No, that's not true. I would say most. not known. I mean, it depends on your perspective. I mean, if the list of phenomena you bring to me and say, these are the things I want to explain, is chosen carefully, then maybe indeed none of the things on your list will be things that I will be able to explain from these sorts of approaches.
So much.
But I think that argument also occurred in lots of contexts, because there were many people that worked on sphere stochastic dynamics. And the real nail in the coffin of that theory was Bell inequality violations. So clearly there's important things that you can't derive from that sort of approach.
But there's enough on the right hand side to, I just prefer to do quantum mechanics on the field theory.
Well, but then you're just not engaging the project of trying to derive the structure that your starting point. You're just going to say, these are the starting point of quantum mechanics, and I'm not going to ask where that comes from. And I'm not going to ask, why it is or what the relationship between quantum theory and classical theories are. Whereas this sort of approach suggests that actually the relationship is a lot tighter than you might have thought, that quantum theory is not so different from classical theories if you introduce this one conceptual innovation, but you need more.
Well, I have a really naive question, but it seems to me when you talk about QED or GR, these are very complicated theories because they're interacting theories. I mean, have you just thought about Maxwell theory and classical Maxwell theory? Or
I'm thinking actually of doing low-energy electrodynamics. When you say classical Maxwell theory, you mean
with without electrons, just free photon or free.
Oh, spectrum. That's just optics, right? So yes, I mean if you can reproduce quantum optics that's restricted to coherent states, right? So you have coherent states and squeeze states and linear transformations on those, homogeneous detection, which are just basically measurements of the quadrature operators. Then you can reproduce all of that with one of these theories.
My question is about this, how Gaussian quantum mechanics fits into this, prisoners in the cave scenario that you described at the beginning. So
yeah.
One possible way of thinking about that is that the shadows on the wall represent the data that we get from conducting experiments and observations, and that the quantum mechanical framework is a nice way to explain what goes on on the stage that we don't really see directly. And are you saying that there's something unsatisfactory about that, and that somehow quantum mechanics explains the stage better, or what is this point?
The actual analogy I had in mind was more of the following form. Let me just draw one of these 3x3 cases where this is position and this is momentum. So the reality is some point here. But now I could choose to measure position, in which case it's like casting a shadow in this direction. And I find out that it's one of these three guys. And so that's my state of knowledge. So I cast a position shadow. But alternatively, I could choose to cast a different shadow and ask, what's its momentum? In which case, my knowledge would be one of these three possibilities. So I can find out about its momentum shadow or its position shadow, but I can't find out both shadows at once. I can't get at the real thing. That's the analogy I had in mind.
Okay.
Two more questions.
I have a question. When you were mentioning field theory, in this framework, do you have any idea of how you would deal with the notion of a normalization group, or how it will arise? Mm-hmm. One typical quantum effect arising loops with the root is.
So I haven't thought about it, but there's a very interesting paper by Bob Holden, and he gave a talk a few years ago where he took a very similar type of approach, where you assume that the vacuum is really classical, this probability distribution of classical field configurations. And he, doing some lattice field theory calculations and a few analytic results, was finding that actually these classical theories came pretty close to the quantum predictions. So there were differences, but he could reproduce most of the low-order predictions of the quantum field theories he was looking at. I don't know what the connection between his. I'm sorry?
Even the running?
I don't remember. Probably not. I don't think he was looking at that.
I mean, just like the basic notion of renormalization occurs in classical theory, right? Like the Ising model. So, maybe the details of what happens in the quantum theories wouldn't get, but the general properties of the
Yeah, but I'm talking about the basic aspects that arise because you need the loops, you know, the tree.
Half the time they do a weak rotation. They're really doing statistical mechanics.
Well, that was another question. In some sense, you know, how is it kind of different from weak rotation idea that,
from weak quantization?
No, weak rotation. You know, all practical purpose when people deal with quantum theories, they just, you know, go to a statistical system.
So you're talking about deriving a statistical theory from...
No, weak rotation is the fact that you...
What's the relevance of the weak rotation?
Well, is that you map your quantum theory onto some statistical system, and then you do all your computation in this statistical system. And then you reinterpret it back. It's like even an equivalent.
T goes to IT.
Yeah. That's weak.
I haven't thought about it. It's an interesting question.
It's like asking there's an analogy between the Schrodinger equation and the diffusion equation. If you made the H bar imaginary, you'd get the diffusion equation. That's essentially like a weak rotation. So the question is that fact have any relevance to what you're saying here, or vice versa?
I don't know. I suspect not, because here it's sort of really critical. If you want to reproduce part of quantum theory, it's critical that you're using a representation of quantum state over a phase space rather than a configuration space. Effectively, it's the Wigner representation is the only one that gets you something similar to these restricted theories.
Maybe we should just take one last question. So I think Joe had I hope this isn't too vague to deserve an answer. So let's see. So the reason why you can't build local different variable theories is the Bell theorems. Right? I mean, it's like there's no other prohibition against building local different variables apart from that. If your theory doesn't violate the Bell inequalities, then we would need something new. Well, there's nothing to stop you from building a local different variables model. Right. So what is it? So what's new here? I'm asking what's the thing you're trying to get at? Are you just trying to delineate like those things that you can do in local hidden variable models from those things you can't in a sharper way than we could before? Or are you suggesting sort of some whole new way of conceiving of local hidden variable models? What's the thing you're really trying to get to?
Well, there's a few things going on. So one thing is that I think previous hidden variable models took the quantum state to be part of the description of reality, whereas this sort of approach, they know that the quantum state is going to be purely a state of knowledge, and so it's a different kind of hidden variable theory in that respect. But I mean, what does this say about Bell inequality evaluations? Not very much. One thing it does tell you is that there's a number of phenomena that people say are instances of non-locality, even though they're not Bell inequality violations. So people often talk about the original EPR experiment as some sort of spooky action at distance, or teleportation, or even this sort of Mach-Zehnder experiment that put out Aronoff-Bohm. All these examples are things that people say, oh, well, that's not a Bell inequality violation. But still, you know, if you want a realist interpretation, you're going to have non-locality. And so these sorts of theories actually show you that all except the Aronoff-Bohm effect, I know that you can mock up the phenomenology of those things within a totally local theory.
Let's thank Robert for a very good question.